This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Welcome, dear listeners, to the newest podcast in this book review series. We are discussing Armelle Choplin's new book, Concrete City, Material Flows and Urbanization in West Africa, which is published with Eider Susk book series, published by Wiley. And we have three really great readers and scholars of the book to discuss the book along with Armelle. So they are Alice Herzog, Prince Kuma, and Wangwe Kimari. They will introduce themselves in just a bit and talk briefly about the book. So we will begin with Prince.
Yeah, thank you so much, Nitin, for the invitation. It was great to really read this book. I enjoyed reading it. Really very interesting insights. About myself, I'm an interdisciplinary social and political scientist whose work sits at the intersection of critical urban studies, infrastructure studies, technology studies, with a focus on development, political economy, and social justice. Currently honorary research fellow at the British Institute in Eastern Africa. I'm also currently guest researcher at the University of Lichtenstein. I am going to introduce a little bit about the book, how I read the book, but I really have to say that I enjoyed reading. To me, the Concrete City really examines concrete as an entry point and departure point in city-making processes. The book casts, in a way, a concrete as a common denominator that lends continuity and shape to emerging urban forms. It historicizes concrete in Africa, positioning the continent as the last cement frontier, and concrete structures as architectures of independence and modernism in Africa. In the book, Armelle Choplin shows how concrete reveals the depth of history in cities often deemed historyless, and she shows how from the Stone Age and the Bronze Age, we've now entered a new material era, a concrete age, which she actually defines as a kind of geological epoch of the Anthropocene. In a time when infrastructural deficits weigh heavily on Africa's development, concrete emerges as a critical material, a real solution at the nexus of infrastructure gaps and bottlenecks. And in this case, concrete is then more than just a promise. It transcends aspirations. It is as real as it gets. It's material, it's tangible, it's concrete. Concrete then is the physical binder that which transforms evolving visions into reality. So in this case, then, concrete sits at the intersection of urban production and achievement of utopias, ideals, visions, and imaginaries, as well as plans. It is needed in and for investments, constructions, agglomerations, accelerations, gentrifications, and extensions, thereby making it a means to realizable futures of cities, not only in Africa, but the global South at large. So the book, in a way, really shows how in our era, concrete has become a really ubiquitous material across time and space, perhaps the most widely used human-made material, so ordinary, so normalized, and so global in its presence that it renders it invisible. So in this case, it is massive yet backgrounded, ordinary yet indispensable, and at the same time, the most productive construction feature. Yet at the same time, it just might be the most environmentally damaging material on Earth. And such is the paradox of concrete. So I really enjoyed reading the book, and I look forward to provocations and insights deriving from it.
Thanks, Prince. Perhaps we could have a word from you, Wangwe, about the book.
Thank you all, and thank you all for this invitation. My name is Wangwe Kimari, and I am a lecturer in the American University Abroad program here in Nairobi. I'm also an honorary research associate at the African Center for Cities. But mostly, I would say I'm just a Nairobian and a dweller of an African city, just trying to think about how we can live more justly in these cities, have cities that are for everyone, and have cities that really encourage the vibrance of different epistemic knowledges and practices. And for sure, reading Amel's book was really interesting for me in many ways. Not only is it well-researched and very expansive in its reach theoretically and also empirically, but it also allowed me to bring together things that I normalized while not really thinking about. And this is the ubiquity of concrete. There's concrete everywhere. I used to work in Angola and really on every streets, people are making what they call blockush. So these blocks, cement blocks for construction everywhere, and they are really quite popular. And I didn't make the connections of cement and cement, how it's tied to power and all of these capital flows. I didn't make it really as, and maybe pun intended, as concretely as when I read Amel's book, and I'm really grateful for that. So well done, Amel, for this really powerful book. That's really important. I think I would like to talk about two things. First, it really also sunk home when you write that the concrete city has emerged as a new icon of African capitalism, which really makes sense because in all of our various blueprints, whether it's from Kigali, and maybe Rwandese would dispute this, but from Kigali to Nairobi to Dar to whether it's the plan for infrastructure development in Africa, it's concrete. Concrete is everywhere and is given unabashedly. It's not there. It's not given with any form of hesitation. And so really when you said that it condenses, it is iconic of African capitalism, it really sunk home. At the same time, though, I was curious that this, even if it's iconic of this supposedly new brand of capitalism called African capitalism, and it's also tied to these world-class visions that we have for cities, it reproduces absences of Africans that African capitalism is supposedly remedying. So in these, what I'm interpreting as these big fixations on tall buildings and bridges and roads, you rarely see Africans. And this is perpetuating a trope of city life and who should be in the city and racial capitalism that supposedly these African capitalist entrepreneurs, but also practices were meant to remedy. Even as you say, concrete has been vernacular. So it's really interesting for me that the contradictions that persist in cement, and it has many social lives, as you say. I'm trying to find a quote where you said that. It definitely has many social lives. It has multiple lives. I think you say that various times, and social meanings. The second thing I would like to talk about is the Anthropocene, because I guess we all have this, I hope we all have this anxiety about what's happening to our planet. But you talk about the Anthropocene a lot in a way that is interesting for me because I'm thinking about the Anthropocene, but also recognize it as a term that's not widely used on the continent. But I'm interested in it because certainly cement, as you say, allows for 8% of global greenhouse emissions. And in all metrics, Africans are probably the least polluters. We have contributed less than 4% of global greenhouse gas emissions. But at this instance, with this construction boom and this construction everywhere, as you point out, along the Lagos-Abidjan corridor, in Addis, in Nairobi, across the continent, what will our greenhouse gas emissions be? But also, how then can we contribute? And I'm trying to say this in a way that is not just in my head. But if we don't use this geological, or we don't have reference to this geological term, but we are now, less so than others, but we are contributing it to it now because of this really intense pursuit of concrete, what will that mean for our lives? And in chapter 4, you talk about people pursuing alternatives to these different forms of building, of understanding, built form that are really a return and bringing forward practices from the past, but also modifying them for the present. I think what I'm trying to say is the Anthropocene is here. Cement shows our role in it too, but also beyond that, just the different effects in our lives, and which you gesture towards now in the fact that cement is not permeable or porous. And so there's increased flooding, there's increased heat effects. You talk about heat a lot, but I was interested in this chapter because I'm interested in, and actually I'm in a project called African in the Anthropocene, because we're trying to think about whether this geological age as a moniker works, but also what does it mean in our lives to be part of this geological age? And your book illustrates for me a little bit about how we are contributing to this geological age, and also pushes further or compels me to think about, okay, and what are these various effects of cement? I hope that's clear, but I really did appreciate this book. Well done, Armel. It's not an easy feat. You pulled together a lot of literatures and approaches that are really commendable. So well done. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Angwe. I think this putting together this book does so well, right? I mean, like concrete, like you describe, Armel, is this binder, like literally it's a binding, there's the binding ingredient that enables us to build houses. But you do a lot of theoretical binding together, a lot of empirical binding together. And I think that's really the feat of this book. So my name is Alice Herzog. I'm a social anthropologist based in Zurich in Switzerland. And I'm interested in questions of mobility, migration, circulation. I have two strands going at the moment. The first is in the field of urban anthropology. I did my PhD with Armel Choplin together with Christian Schmidt. And we spent a lot of time in the field together. So I was looking at this Lagos-Abidjan corridor through the prism of migration and belonging. And then my second thread is looking at the circulation or the mobility of contested heritage, especially contested colonial heritage in ethnographic museums. And those two things connect together, and they connected more together as I was reading or rereading this book. As I read this, of course, it brings up a lot of memories of being in the field with Armel. And I was just remembering what a good interviewer she is. The first time I met Armel, it was at the University of Abu Mikalavi in Benin. And within 5 minutes, she got more out of me than I would normally tell someone over about 6 months. And I thought, she's just very good at asking the right questions, because she's interested in the answers as well. And I think, Wangwe, what you said about interested in what does it mean? What does it mean to envisage social justice within an African urban landscape? And that's something that motivates this work. I remember Armel slamming the brakes on her car because she's seen a cement shop pop up that wasn't there the week before, and rushing out to ask them how much they were selling cement for. But all of these various different entry points that come across in the book as she tells the story of cement in West Africa, and you go from interviewing kind of the CEO of cement companies to interviewing very disenfranchised groups trying to pull together enough funds to build their house. And I think that's the richness of this book, is that you're getting so many different perspectives through this one object. You're bridging all of these different social worlds in order to tell a story about these emerging urban landscapes. And this method, right, this method of following the thing, which is a method that's established. We've read Marcus or Apadurai and the Social Life of Things. And this is something that you, in your earlier work on globalization from below, is that how? Yeah, I think inconspicuous globalization, that you reference as well, these various studies that follow flip-flops or t-shirts or secondhand cars or motorbikes. And yet with this question of cement, it really makes sense to apply this method. Like, I felt that what you're able to do in doing that is to make this sprawling urbanization along the Lagos-Abidjan corridor tangible. This thing that somehow is so big that as a researcher, it's so difficult to grasp and to say, what is this new metropolitan area? It's spread across five nations. It's spread across different linguistic groups. You've got Anglophone spaces, Francophone spaces. And by bringing it all the way down to the bag of cement, you give us something to hold on to as we move across that space. And that as a reader is great because we're always going back to the tangible, back to something that you can hold in your mind and think through. And you can think through in other places as well, because of course those bags of cement are not just in West Africa, but they're in other sites that we know. And so I felt that's a kind of gift to the reader, enabling us to have that kind of comparative lens as well, thinking through other sites we're familiar with and how does cement play out in those sites. And then I think prints the point you brought up at the beginning about these contradictions, right? These contradictions in this material is something that runs through those books. I was just noting a few of them, that this kind of social verticality, in that this is a material that's being used by the richest, but it's also being used by the poorest. This is a material that enables us to talk about global flows, but also very local structures. This is a material that is a symbol of colonial power, but is also a symbol of post-colonial construction, or just simply that kind of classic formal informal binary. And I think what this book does is it shows us a way of like thinking through those different contradictions, and that those contradictions, they flourish together in this West African urban space. And that's what makes it so intriguing, right? Is that it's neither one nor the other. It's happening together, and it's booming together, and it's busting together. And that for me is the kind of force of this book. Yeah. And then of course, we spent this time together in the field in West Africa. You then moved to Switzerland, where you're now professor of geography in Geneva. And Switzerland that has its own particular relationships with cement as well, home to Holcim, a large cement company, and also home to intellectual academic conversations around cement. I'm thinking about, for example, the work of Sarah Nichols in Lausanne, looking at the kind of genealogy of the cement industry in Switzerland, home to innovative research on the future of cement building processes, home to Le Corbusier. You mentioned Le Corbusier in your book and how at the end of his life, he ends up living in a cabin. I didn't know this, but he moves away from the concrete structure and finishes his life in a cabin. I thought that was intriguing, and I wanted to ask you if your perspectives on cement have shifted as you've moved to a place of global, like to the heart of global commodity trading, Geneva, from the building sites in Cotonou.
Thanks for these really nice comments. Armel, would you like to go with the short response, perhaps?
Yeah, thank you first, Nitin, for invitation. And thank you to Alice Wangui and Prince for your generous comments. I'm very glad to hear your feedback because it's very important. First, because I really enjoy your work and your work are a strong contribution also for African studies. So it's always a pleasure to exchange with colleagues you admire and respect. So thank you so much. And thank you for your comments because it's really relevant and it gives me food for thought. I would just try to answer to your point, Wangui, and maybe to build upon your work, Prince, on infrastructure, because in my work, I talk a lot about housing, but not many on infrastructure. And I think maybe after we could exchange on that, as it's true that I focused a lot on people building their houses in concrete. And also, Alice, you mentioned the methodology and also the fact that now I am in Switzerland. I didn't mention it, but yes, I'm professor of geography and urban planning here at the University of Geneva. And it was a big change when I arrived from the University of Abomey-Calavi in Benin and I moved to Geneva. And of course, concrete is completely now part of my life because, yes, I am in the country of Le Corbusier, in the country of Holcim, in the country of the bunkers, the concrete bunkers. So, of course, it also echoes what I have done on the field in Africa. Maybe I would like just to start about the issue of Anthropocene, and it's also something linked to the comment of Alice about Switzerland. I was very shocked when I arrived in Switzerland and mostly when I came back in Europe to see that my book was published and the French edition was published in 2020 in a moment when
concrete became a problem, because before it was completely a global consensus on cement. And in Africa, you had the investment on cement plants from donors. So it was completely part of the discourse of development, and especially for emerging countries and big cement tycoons, such like Aliko Dangote, the Nigerian, is seen as a one of the one who has developed Africa, okay? And people are grateful to him for that.
In the book, you'd speak to a school kid who says, oh, I'm not sure if I want to become like a footballer or if I want to become like Dangote.
He's the guy who embodies success in Africa and is the richest, because the richest man in Africa through the, yes, through cement and the construction boom. So for me, it was a moment I discovered that, yes, the whole consensus surrounding cement in Africa, the fact that Anthropocene was not really a concern because people have so many concerns to challenge, to deal with every day. So maybe environment, ecology is not the priority. And it's not because they don't care. It's just because they are focused on other things. And at the same time in Europe, it was the moment, yes, the first attacks against Holcim, Lafarge, the fact that we had in Switzerland, the first ZAD, the zone to defend, with people, activists occupying Holcim quarry near Lausanne. So it was like something very disturbing. And for me, at the end, I am reflecting a lot on that, because for me, maybe it's one of the main challenges for the next decades. So the fact that now Africa and African people are also considered as polluters, and it was not the case before, because pollution was something created and the results of European, Western countries, I would say. And now the fact that even African cities have an important carbon footprint is a real issue. And at the same time, we cannot ask to African dwellers, city dwellers, to start to say, no, they don't deserve a concrete house, okay? It's also, so for me, my book is not a manifesto against concrete, such as some of them which were published at that time, because it's more than that. Concrete in Africa, you've got a real claim for concrete. People want concrete because it's a way also to legitimate is the place in the city. It's a way also for women not to have to rebuild each year after floodings the house. So to save time to care the children, for example, instead of rebuilding the house. So this huge debate about architecture, about what I call the dangerous return of the vernacular, it's something very interesting. And just to close on that subject, maybe the fact that Francis Kéré, the Burkinabé architect, won the Pritzker Prize two years ago, at the same time, it's a real hope, because we can imagine that we can build new kind of architecture with local materials, with the idea that even poor people deserve comfort, and yes, with houses in earth or in bamboo or in wood, and it's great. But at the same time, Francis Kéré can be also instrumentalized by Western societies saying, okay, African people, they just can build such, so it will be better for the planet if they could stay and if they could go back to the huts, okay? So for me, it's a very dangerous, it's very ambiguous, and this return of the vernacular and the idea that the concrete city is for Western countries and African countries just does not deserve it. So it's also, yes, African cities are concrete cities, especially Nairobi or Kigali or Kampala. So yes, that's my point on Anthropocene and the ecological questions.
And I think this is maybe a first contribution of the book that those of us a bit more familiar with African urbanity would overlook, like the fact to say, hey, places in Africa are concrete too.
Yeah.
Full stop. I feel that's already an important observation to make and to make known as well, that you're not going to be writing about earth huts and bamboo walls, that these are places that are inscribed in the same material modernity and the same material kind of contradictions as elsewhere as well.
Yes, exactly. Because, yeah, it's also, as you mentioned, for the richest people, but also for the poorest. And poor people also yeah, that just have the right to live in a concrete house. It's just not for rich and Western or the elite in Africa. And that's the reason it's very complicated to think the future, the urban futures without concrete. And also for houses, but also for infrastructure, Prince, as you worked a lot on unfinished and the incompleteness of infrastructure. And of course, there are concrete infrastructures. So yeah, for me, that's really interesting to have the global picture of that.
Yes. And the ambivalence and ambiguity of concrete for me, I think, is really a great contribution that the book brings out. I was really provoked by, I think I'll just go to the vernacularization and socialization of cement and concrete that Wangoi and Alice and yourself, Amel, just mentioned. For me, I find it very interesting how much concrete has become so socialized and vernacularized. And of course, like Alice, just like you said, Alice, African cities are very much concrete cities. So in my research work, there are many times that I've come across different kinds of examples just showing how much concrete is at the center of how populations inhabit cities in Africa, in Nairobi, in Kampala. You could say that we define modernity and urbanization through concrete. And very often, city makers define modernity through concrete. So I could provide an example of how, in cases where modernity is commonly measured by concrete, used or to be used in development of plans and technological projects. So concrete here becomes a marker of progress and aspiration in cities that are developing. And now what you have are cities that have become more or less concrete jungles, farms of stones. And this precisely because for many decision makers, planners, governors, and policymakers, the choice between concrete and greenery is always clear. It's always concrete over greenery, concrete over trees. And then this percolates down to the everyday life aspects of cities, their inhabitations. So city residents often define urbanization and progress through concrete. So for instance, one thing that I've observed in Kampala, for instance, is that the first thing that one does once they buy a plot of land is to, let's say, 50 by 100 feet plot of land. The first thing they'll do is to cut down all the trees. The next thing they will do is to build a perimeter wall around the plot and then set up a structure, let's say, 2 or 3 bedroom house. And the remaining space is tiled, so you tile all the remaining space for the kids to play, for one to park their vehicle or whatever. And once I had a conversation with someone who explained that for many, trees associated with rural life, while concrete or cement signifies urbanity. So over time, this perception has evolved into an elite status symbol, where the extent of concrete used in shaping urban spaces defines the extent of progress and aspirations and modernity. So here as well, the choice between concrete and greenery is clear, and it's always concrete over greenery. And the last example that I want to highlight is how when you speak with many folks in like Kampala, for instance, when you speak about expenditures and the value of money and all of this, people's minds are often very quick to calculate how many bags of cement that amount of money could buy. So all this really speaks to how much concrete and cement have been very socialized in a way. They become vernacular concepts, but in a way it also speaks really to the ambivalence of the whole aspect of the cement city.
I think those are some of my favorite moments in the book, is that when Amar is interviewing people building their houses and then describing their calculations of how, like, the site manager has cheated them on how many bags, and they go and count how many bags they would need per square meter for the fence. And like you say, that kind of those automatic, it's almost like it's an arithmetic that's very embodied in city making. How many bags of cement do you need? Something. And it's interesting listening to you, Prince, about how this story of cement somehow can't be told without the story of trees, right? Or the kind of like the cutting back of trees and greenery. And I remember when we were in Cotonou, there was a eviction process in it, and the vocabulary used or the explanations were quite often similar to slash and burn agriculture, this idea that you needed to cut back the city in order for it to grow up again, or this fear of being overwhelmed by informal growth, like informal greenery or weeds coming back. I think it's the Komarovs who use that kind of idea of weeds a lot in their writing. What also struck me was how kind of colonial powers had cut back a lot of trees as well, because they were seen as being very powerful and part of the voodoo culture, right? And so there's a cutting back of trees in order to try and cut back on traditional practices in the city as well, a clearing out of those cultural practices to make room for the colonial city as well at the beginning.
If I can just add something to that, one of all of you have signaled, as Arnel does it so well here, how the intimacies we have with concrete, how it's even a basic commodity in some African countries, which for me was really startling, considering in Nairobi we don't have water, for example. But anyway, it's certainly a commodity. But building on what you're saying, Alice, some, and it's bad, maybe I shouldn't use this word, but some redemption in the concrete city for me was the realization and the gesturing towards that it's not total. In 50 to 70 years, it's going to be rubble. There's going to be openings, some of them very tragic. I know, Amel, you talk about some of the buildings falling, not just in Africa, but in Europe. But openings where there's recognitions that it's not total, but equally tied to that, that it's porous also for the immaterial world. Spirits will go through, even if we see it as inviolate, unmodern and very powerful spirits can also be part of these infrastructures. And so for me, those were critical for me, who needs some to think about how we are going to escape this concrete life as I look at my very concrete walls. It was very, there was some reassurance in that despite the proliferation of cement factories, which we also understand bring jobs, even as they decimate landscapes through extraction, a contradiction that for me gives some potential for this unconcrete city is not only the creation of rubble, you talk about how there's a quote in the book where you talk about how the marks of our progress will be seen in the rubble or something like that, but equally in the recognitions that in Benin and of all places, the home of voodoo, that these walls can keep away water. Maybe they're cheap, but they represent modernity for us. But there's always these immaterial presences that are there.
Yeah, I try to be also, yes, to be positive and think that it can be a redemption, as you mentioned, can exist. It's true that we need to work on the imaginaries, as you mentioned, because as you mentioned, Prince, the idea that if you built with concrete, you are successful, you are modern. So the idea of modernity, which is also a legacy from the colonial time. At the same time, we want to give up with the colonial time, but at the same time, we reproduce the same thing. So with the ruins also of the colonial time. But at the same time, also this opposition between green and concrete and the idea that now we are trying to produce green concrete. And I was in Kigali last April and I saw the huge ad in the city saying building a sustainable city with the new green cement. And it was the locally produced Rendan cement. So it's really interesting how in the supposed green city, the Eastern green city in Kigali, we are producing the city with green cement. It's a part of discourse, a part of imaginaries, a part also of reality. As you said, concrete is produced to last 50 or 70 years in Western countries, in not tropical areas. So in Africa, maybe in some part of Africa, it will last 20 years and it will become rebels. But rebels, it's, we don't need to think about the circular metabolism such like in Europe, because it's already there. When there is a collapse in Cotonou or in Dakar, the taxi moto is already there. The tuk-tuk is already there to pick up all the rebels to recreate something. So it's really interesting. And also the fact that you're right, the history of concrete, it's only 150 years in the total history of the humanity. So maybe it's just a parenthesis, and we could imagine that something else will be produced. People are already trying to think to build alternatively, maybe not without concrete, but maybe with less concrete, with also, I don't know, houses smaller or this kind of other vision. And you're right, we've got many spirits also. The fact that when you... Yeah, and we have seen that many times with Alice, when you need to demolish the building, you need to, yeah, to ask the Vodun if we can, and to celebrate and to make a celebration, to ask the right to demolish that. Yes, it's material, it's also immaterial. And that's very interesting to think that maybe we could escape the concrete city, which is also a legacy from the colonial city. I went to Nairobi and I saw the beautiful school of architecture in concrete. So the brutalist period was also, Africa was also a playground from a brutalist architects. It was for me important to replace Africa in this discourse of regarding architecture, regarding, yeah, urban planning and cities, not as an exception, but it's also regarding the concrete city is also a way to deromanticize and desoxycitize the African city. Yeah, it was my objective too.
Armel, I just had a reflection on based on this really spirited conversation between all of you about this sort of very quiet fight that you're having with Harvey in the book as well, which is like subtext, where you're trying to decenter and play with the whole spatial fix idea of spatial fix, where Harvey's famous thing around spatial fix is that, you know, China, after the 2008 financial crisis, puts more concrete into the ground than the Western world has in the last 100 years. And I always try to think of it like, where did that concrete go? And you bring these beautiful anecdotes all throughout the book, where you're talking about, for instance, the Chinese clinker coming at half the price into Africa, and the African cement or the African concrete not being actually African, in the sense of how the sort of urbanization is indeed quite planetary, in the sense of how these commodities are taking shape and how they're being poured and how they're falling into place, whether it be these Indian companies coming in or some other companies from the global south, and how it's very difficult to put a finger on the sites of the spatial fix as well, which I found very interesting as a method that you're following in the book. And I was constantly comparing it also with what's happening in India, in the sense of very similarly, semantically, how informal communities are constructed as kaccha, which is lacks concrete, and then formality is always seen as something that has concrete associated with it. But historically, it's been a bit hand-poured concrete, and now it's becoming this sort of, even if it was brutalist, how Corbusier, for instance, constructed in India or in the global south, it was all very poured by hand, by women and by marginal workers working on site, with not with big machinery, but very humanly shaped and humanly modified kind of things. And now there's this sort of huge machine, but actually not the way you're showing that, illustrating that in the book. I found really beautiful.
Thank you, Nitin, for your generous comment. Yes, Harvey inspired me a lot when he worked on concrete, or did this reference to concrete consumption in China. And when I heard him, I said, wow. But when I look at all the pictures I took during the last decades on African cities, they are all gray. Everything is gray, because we think to Africa like the huge continent park green, but at the end the cities are really gray. And so for me it was interesting to look at this new kind of spatial fix. So you mentioned the Indian companies, steel. So it's very It's interesting because it's at the same time very visible. We know that Chinese are in Africa, and Prince and Wangui have worked a lot on that. So their work are very inspiring about, yes, Chinese in Africa. We know that Lebanese are in Africa, and they were then before, and also Indian. So we know that. But at the same time, I've got the impression that, for example, from the European perspective, we don't know exactly what is happening there. So the fact that Indians are now investing a lot in steel, in the steel companies producing in Africa and not only importing, producing in Africa and taking the huge containers after when they are empty, when the Chinese commodities have been sold in Africa, and after taking the containers to go back to India with the steel collected informally in Western African cities. It's a huge new circulation, and people ignore that, the inconspicuous globalization. And we worked on that with my colleague Olivier Pliès. And so for me, this new special fix, which are not evidence such like Eco-Atlantic City. Okay, of course, we have seen the special fix in China. We have seen the new perspective in Dubai at one time in the 90s, and after in India, the shining India, and now in Africa. But it's at the same time visible and invisible. In Nairobi, you've got ad with McKinsey or Knight Franks everywhere. But I don't know if people know who is McKinsey or who is Knight Franks. Okay, so this big consultancy firm, which are here to invest, to make profit, to buy retail, housing, residential offices. So it's clear. And they are here in the street. I saw that when I met Wangui some 3 weeks ago. And it's visible, but people don't know it. So it's completely, for me, interesting, this special fix circulating all around the world with new places, new points, new this kind of industries, such like the Indian investing on steel or ties. Because maybe this is my new research is on ties, as you mentioned, Prince, and rebars, iron rebars in Africa. So yes, and the visible and invisible. And that's what is maybe the most interesting to follow for me, to try to understand and to grasp this urbanization and construction boom.
Sorry, did I get that, Arman? Your new project is on tires.
Tiles, yeah.
Oh, tiles, like tiling tiles. Ceramic tiles.
Yes, okay. Ceramic, as the Prince mentioned, because the ties, it's so relevant also for that. Which kind of ties are coming from Spain, from Italy? I'm working also on marble in Egypt and the marble extractivism. So ordinary marble, ordinary extractivism.
Are you going to go through the Home Depot catalogue?
I think that there is
and review all of the materials, huh?
Not all the material, but I think that steel, ceramic ties, marble, because marble is really the surplus, so we don't need marble. We can understand we need concrete, but we don't need marble or we don't need ties. But the idea of finishing, which is the idea that you are someone very important because you've got the money to finish your house. Something, the distinction is also something I think relevant to understand the cities right now.
Yeah. I love the bit in the book where you're, because I observed you doing this, jumping out of your car and putting GPS locations on different cement shops, but how you track, so you track where the cement sellers are in order to track where the city growth is, but then you take that to the second level and then you track where the shops are selling these other kind of more fine, like deco products, like the taps and the tiles and the solar panels, to see where are people at a point where they've already built enough that they can start by thinking about these other elements. It's like such a smart, like such a tangible way of thinking about urban growth. We always talk about urban growth, but like, how do you bring it down to those kind of material indicators, and how do you pop that on a map?
And for me also, how you think about concrete itself and how you actually research it and work with it. Because if I were to think about concrete, I would think of it through this temporality of a permanence, where concrete is solid, it's static, it's intact, seemingly immutable thing. And yet you actually go beyond this in your work and you explore concrete's multiple lives through material flows, movements, and conduits. And so in a way, you examine different kinds of articulations of motion, circulations, the dynamism of concrete, where then it's no longer this very static material. But then, you know, the concrete that then leads to what you then call as the concrete city. Yeah, but it's also really important. I think also interesting to think of the concrete city as something that is time-bound. And at the same time, also the concrete city as something that is energy intensive. I think then it becomes important to then not think of it as a forever thing. So what the book does, at least for me, is that it provokes us to think about the long-term effects of concrete after it's gone. And I think that's where we can begin then to think about what the alternatives could be. And I think what your book actually does is that it provokes open-ended questions for further research, where for me, one of the key provocations is that it is possible, or it must be possible, to think about other modes of being, other modes of operability beyond concrete. It must be possible to think of other viable, sustainable innovations beyond concrete, but also within concrete itself, like the examples that you provide that you just provided now from Kigali. So one of the open-ended questions for me is, how could we possibly give a visibility to a non-concrete city as urbanists? And what are its ecological and vernacular architectures and urbanisms that are possible to think with? And how would, you know, a sustainable concrete city or a non-concrete city actually look like? The other question is, how could we possibly turn the tides to reimagine the concrete city itself as a viable and sustainable city? But the other really perhaps much broader open-ended question that I began to think about as I finished with the conclusion was, if we were to map the geopolitics of concrete, the global markets, the national policies to transnational interests, what would this map look like? How would it trace the flows of raw materials, the labor migrations, the financial networks that sustain the concrete city? These, for me, are questions that invite deeper reflections on ways in which concrete shapes not just the built environment, but also the geopolitical and economic futures of African cities, and perhaps even more broadly, southern cities as well.
Very good question, Prince. I'm very, of course, I would like to go further, and we could do this research together, and especially with economists, because this issue of financial flows, it's very complicated. It's easier to follow the materiality, and that's what I did, because it was here evident, and we could see and follow these materials. But following flows of materials, following flows of capital, flows of migrants, flows of IDs, flows of lobbies on the social media, and how they also worked, because people today are choosing their houses on Pinterest or on other application, and they say to the bricklayers, I want that. And that would be the next step, and I would be very happy to do that with you, as it's a huge work. But I think it's still a good entry to understand, or try to understand, what is happening not only in Africa, but quite everywhere, because the concrete city is an ubiquitous city. That's the big problem maybe for the future. But as Wangui said, we can try to find a redemption. And another unconcrete city.
Can I just say, Amel, you really have been able to, in a very coherent way, bring together so many circulations, whether we see that concrete is African intimacy aspirations, but it's also gypsum from Spain. It's also Dangote's empire. You really have done a good job in, I think, one that's very hard to do, in you're following the thing, but in ways that really showcase multiple circulations and multiple times and in a way that is articulated so that we can follow. So well done, because that's not an easy task, to talk about Porto Novo and Accra and your friend's house and clinkers from China in a way that comes together. So really well done for that.
Thank you. But I had the chance to meet very nice and incredible colleagues in Benin, in Togo, in Accra, in Ghana, and in Nigeria, but also colleagues coming from Switzerland. So like Alice, and it was great to do field work with many students also. So it's a collective research. I just want to precise with many colleagues locally, many friends.
Maybe can I just say quickly to French speakers listening to this podcast, download the French version of this book.
Matière grise de l'urbain.
Matière grise de l'urbain. It's free to download, and it's got I feel like additional images, like the photos and maps compared to the English version of the book.
Yeah, the English version is quite arid. I've got like 20 pictures in the French version. I've got many, because it was an architect publisher, so used to deal with graphism, and it's really nice. And there is a version online with other pictures, links, websites. So maybe that's the reason the French version it's better regarding the...
I wouldn't say it's better. I just say to French speakers out there, download the French.
Yeah. I mean, it's regarding the pictures and the illustration. It's an interesting work, and the English version is more theoretical. So I rewrote many parts of.
But this is something that you do as well, right? Is that you're bridging that Anglophone and that Francophone literature along that corridor.
Yeah, this is for me very important to publish a book talking about Francophone countries in English to know what is happening, because sometimes African Anglophone countries, even people in Nigeria don't know what is happening in Togo or in Benin, just 100 kilometers from Lagos. And on the other side, I think it's very important also to have a French publication for Francophone audience, for the students in open access. And it's also something for what I am struggling every day to disseminate a lot work in French, in English, and to try to make a bridge between and I hope, but I don't speak Portuguese, but to do this also with the Lusophone parts. But this is in my position in Switzerland, I try to do that because I'm able to, I've got good conditions, and I try to make the links between all this part of Africa and the rest of the world, of course.
Right. Thanks for the wonderful conversation. This was really spirited and very, very generative. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to you.
Thanks, Nathan.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website, urbanpolitical.podig.io.